طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. Palestinian resistance to the colonization of their homeland is being played out on campuses all over the United States, creating enormous concern to the Jewish establishment, which is spending large sums of money to counter this growing phenomenon. Today we examine one of those struggles at the University of California's Law School at Berkeley. We present a discussion of their particular campus battle in a debate between Dylan Saba, an attorney with Palestine Legal, who represents the Palestinian students at Berkeley, and Ethan Katz, a professor of history and Jewish studies at the university. The discussion is moderated by journalist and college professor Peter Beiner.
I'm really thrilled to be joined today by Dylan Saba and Ethan Katz. This is a this subject about the controversy over student groups not being willing to invite Zionist speakers at Berkeley Law School has been extremely incendiary. And I wasn't frankly that optimistic that I could find two people as thoughtful and well-informed as Dylan and Ethan, who would be willing to talk to one another. Because as we all know, it's often quite difficult to host conversations on this subject. And so I'm really grateful to both of them. And I'm grateful to all of you for participating. I think we probably have a pretty fairly wide spectrum of people in terms of opinions on this subject, which is precisely why I wanted to do this. So regardless of where you fall on this view, on what you think happened, I'm really, really glad you're here, and I welcome your questions and express your opinions in the chat, but please be respectful to one another. So Dylan Saba is a staff attorney at Palestine Legal. He is also a graduate of California Berkeley Law School and has advised the student groups in question. He's also my colleague as a contributing editor at Jewish Currents. Ethan Katz is an associate professor of history and Jewish studies at Berkeley and also the co-founder and co-director of Berkeley's Anti-Semitism Education Initiative. Dylan, I'm going to start with you. Maybe you could just tell us, as you understand it, what actually happened here in terms of what the students' groups did and why you support it.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Peter. And thanks, Ethan, for being here and putting this on and everyone who's joined. I'll start and I'll give kind of like a quick summary of what happened. It's not that complicated. It's actually, you know, relatively simple. And so I want to actually spend most of my initial comments here talking about some of the context for this action and, you know, and similar kinds of advocacy and why I support it. So basically what happened in August of this year, Law Students for Justice in Palestine at Berkeley, so a group of Berkeley law students, Palestinian Muslims, you know, Jews in solidarity, other social justice minded folk, they started a campaign where they asked allied student groups basically to adopt BDS into their bylaw support for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And a bunch of other student groups did. And the bylaw they're asking these student groups to adopt basically says, we support BDS, we support the BDS movement. And to support BDS in furtherance of that, we're not going to invite anyone to speak who opposes the BDS call. And so for folks who are unfamiliar, BDS is a strategy of kind of organized nonviolent resistance. You know, people around the world and in the United States to participate in. That uses a series of tactics to advance the call for three main demands. Those are the end to the occupation of all Arab lands in the region and the dismantling of the apartheid wall, equal rights for everyone between the river and the sea, and then a recognition of the right of return for the 7+ million Palestinian refugees who are currently living in exile. So that's what happened. Student groups adopted the bylaw, and then, you know, sometime later, basically a media storm started because, you know, this former Trump official basically wrote this incendiary op-ed saying that these groups were banning Jews. Okay, so that's what happened. And I think that to understand, you know, why this group would do something like this, why this movement exists, we need to back up and talk a little bit about the context of what's happening in Palestine. So we're now in the seventh decade of occupation. What that means is that a third generation of Palestinians are being born into exile. The occupation is about as brutal as it's ever been. Homes are still being demolished. Entire villages are being regularly demolished. Palestinian children are being extrajudicially executed. They're being detained without charges. They're being tortured and tried in military tribunals. I'm not sure any other country in the world is doing that. You know, Israel routinely launches military assaults on Gaza that massacre civilians, that obliterates infrastructure. And then, you know, in the siege that's enforced jointly with Egypt, they prevent the resources necessary for rebuilding from being entered into the strip. Institutional racism pervades Israeli society and Israeli law. It functions basically to ghettoize Palestinians, and otherwise cleanse them from the land. There's some armed resistance in Palestine, but, you know, it's up against a nuclear power that's fully backed by the United States. And then Israel has basically an openly fascist government. It's had, you know, hard right fascist government basically for as long as I can remember. And for the folks who are in college, basically as long as they've been alive. And the future is not really much brighter. Young people in Israel are, you know, contra kind of trends in the rest of the world, extremely right wing. So there's not much hope in terms of, you know, the Israeli polity, you know, kind of moving left without actually enfranchising Palestinians, which Zionists are unwilling to do for the most part. So, okay, what's happening in the United States? Ideological support for Israel, Zionism, is bipartisan. It's basically the well-established hegemonic view. It doesn't really matter what Israel does. U.S. politicians are going to affirm the, you know, the sacred bond between the state of Israel, special relationship, etc. These are the bonds of empire. You know, it makes sense why, you know, the right is going to support Israel. Like if you're in the Republican Party, like for the most part, you're either probably a reactionary or an imperialist or you're both. So you don't need, you know, an excuse for why it's okay to, you know, exterminate Palestinians. And then you have liberals who maybe are not comfortable with what's happening with the extermination, but they're invested in Israel as the fulfillment of like a, you know, a neo-racist Wilsonian national self-determination project. And they're so invested in that, that they prefer the status quo to Palestinian liberation. Most Jewish Americans fit into that latter category, but the numbers are slowly shifting. So if you're a Palestinian in the US, you know, the support that you do have comes from the left, comes from the solidarity of other oppressed peoples, and it comes from sympathetic people that you're able to reach with your story. So let's say you're Palestinian, you're looking to get politically involved. Okay, what are your options then? Electoral organizing. People do it. The idea there is, okay, you get you know, politicians to oppose U.S. foreign policy on their own or in coalition with one another. Honestly, at this point, good luck. You know, there are people and there are organizations that do this, but it's a huge uphill battle. Even the furthest left politicians that we have seem pretty willing to throw, you know, kind of basic Palestinian demands under the bus whenever things get dicey. I support it as a long-term project, but it's not really going to be the strategy of students and you know, and the grassroots. You know, in order to actually affect legislative change, there's going to need to be a mass movement exerting pressure. And so a lot of the grassroots organizations are focused on that kind of base building, you know, mobilizing the grassroots type strategy. So if you're interested in doing that, and there's basically two options that we see in the movement. There's direct action. So that's like organizing protests and specific events. Really a lot of great organizing happens in this space, but it's not quite as good for sustained campaigns, right? You're mobilizing people on specific days for specific events. And sometimes there can be higher barriers to entry. And then the other tactic that you have is BDS. And BDS is a great strategy because what you can do is you can build out support and build from existing networks of solidarity at all kinds of institutional levels. So it can be at your university, it can be at a city level, it can be at your church, it can be at your synagogue, whatever, you know, whatever kind of institutions you're a part of, you can build solidarity within those communities. And push for BDS. The other reason why I support it as a tactic is because it actually has a key message that's baked into it. So instead of like, you know, kind of seeding definitions of what Zionism is, you know, to people who are, you know, going to advance this kind of like Wilsonian mumbo jumbo, you know, language that's like has, you know, nothing to do with actually conditions on the ground and the specifics. What it does is it advances a Palestinian definition of Zionism that's implicit in the call itself by saying, look, you know, Zionist basically means you oppose either ending the occupation, giving, you know, everyone equal rights between the river and the sea, or you oppose the right of return for Palestinian refugees. So that's what these students did. You know, they started a BDS campaign. People want to frame this as, you know, an act of exclusion. It's not really an act of exclusion. Like, none of these groups were hosting Zionist speakers anyways. What it is it's an act of political expression. It's not, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with identity. The way that BDS works basically is if you support the call, then you're not subject to the boycott. So, you know, that's what happened. They made a public declaration. They said, this is what Zionism is. We oppose it. We call on others to oppose it. You know, and I think unsurprisingly, you know, groups of oppressed peoples showed solidarity.
Great.
And that's why I support it.
Thanks for that, Dylan. Ethan, I want to turn it over to you. Dylan, to talk for around 10 minutes or so, so maybe make that your guideline, or you can speak for less and we'll have more time for conversations. But so first, if you have any differences on the specifics of what actually happened or anything you want to add that you think is relevant, please do. And then maybe talk about why you think this was wrong.
Yeah, sure. First of all, I just want to thank you for having me on, Peter. Thanks for joining the conversation, Dylan. We do not have enough opportunities for these kinds of conversations. And it's one of the reasons that I felt it was important to participate. So I hope we'll have a fruitful dialogue. So there are a number of things Dylan said with which I disagree. That's undoubtedly unsurprising, particularly in terms of the characterization of the situation on the ground in Israel-Palestine. I don't want to get deep into the weeds on that, and we may get more into it as we go along. I do just want to say broadly, I heard terminology about ethnic cleansing and a fascist government for decades and extermination. And as a historian who has studied those phenomena, I just have to say that I think we have to be far more careful with those terms. I oppose strongly the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, and I've spoken out against it for many years, and I have huge, deep concerns about the direction of Israel today and about human rights issues in Israel. And I think there's plenty of room for vigorous debate about those. But I think that when we start to throw around terms that frankly are not sustainable comparatively in terms of the way that they've been used in most cases and what's going on the ground, no matter how critical or upset we are, then we do a disservice to the conversation. And we frankly do a disservice to those people who we wish to help on the ground. In terms of the bylaws themselves, I think we should talk about what they actually say, because they do not just support BDS. The bylaws specifically, and the part that has received by far the most attention and objection, it's not just opposing BDS. It's not just saying that speakers who oppose BDS are not going to be invited to speak. It says we will not invite speakers that have expressed and continue to hold views in support of Zionism, the apartheid state of Israel, and the occupation of Palestine. That's a quote from the bylaws. And now, really, this expresses, I believe, a set of rather extreme positions, because the fact of the matter is, you know, what we have here is, first of all, Israel's described as an apartheid regime, full stop. When we say we oppose the occupation of Palestine, and we heard this also in Dylan in his opening remarks, it's very clear we're not talking about the occupation of the West Bank. We're characterizing all Israeli sovereignty in every inch of historic Palestine as occupation. And Zionism, while I think it's very important to acknowledge that Zionism's meaning for Palestinians is highly, highly relevant to the conversation. What Edward Said famously called Zionism from the standpoint of its victims is very important. Like all national liberation movements in the world, an important starting point for defining it is also what the Zionists themselves call Zionism, what Zionists from very early have called Zionism. And for decades, millions of Zionists and Israeli Jews around the world have seen Zionism as a national liberation movement for the Jewish people, a movement to overturn centuries of pogroms, expulsions, total political insecurity in places around the world. And broadly speaking, Zionism is still understood as a movement for the collective rights and security of the Jewish people in some portion of Israel, Palestine, their historic homeland. And there's lots of variations. We obviously see, I think, a very extreme right variation of Zionism that is ascendant in Israel today. As I said, to me, that's deeply troubling. But it ranges from that to advocates for a binational Jewish Arab state. So to claim that Zionism, by definition, means disenfranchisement of Palestinians is not accurate. There are many Zionists like myself who believe deeply in Palestinian collective and individual rights and who advocate for them. But more specifically, in terms of the bylaws, once the bylaws said that anyone who supports Zionism could not ever come to speak, again, I have to take issue with the claim that no Zionists would be speaking for these groups. There were certainly I'm sure many speakers who came to speak on issues ranging from torts to the Supreme Court, who, if you ask them if they support the existence of the state of Israel as a Jewish state, might not be a central issue for them, might not be one of the top 10 issues for them, who would say yes. But the implications of these bylaws are that that person would no longer be able to be invited to speak. The most immediate implication of these bylaws for the campus, however, is their impact upon Jewish Zionist students. And we know from credible polling that in terms of American Jewry, somewhere from 60 to 80 some percent of people express support for Zionism in terms of strong attachment to the Jewish state or strong attachment to Israel as a fundamental and important part of their Jewish identity. So we know we're talking about a very high percentage of the Jewish students at the law school. I know that it's not all of them. I know there are Jewish students there who are affiliated with Students for Justice in Palestine, but it's a very high percentage of the Jewish students at the law school. And they came to feel immediately that they faced a kind of impossible dilemma, which was either they had to express no affiliation with Israel and kind of detach themselves from any connection to Israel, no matter how fundamental that was to their Jewish identity, or they had to quietly dissociate from these clubs. It's important to point out some of the clubs, obviously Students for Justice in Palestine being the best example, but some of the other clubs also have longstanding attachment to the Palestinian cause and to a very hard position on the Middle East conflict. But there were clubs like Women of Berkeley Law or the Queer Alliance at Berkeley Law, where Jewish students have been involved for many years, and that have not a particular attachment to the Middle East conflict, where Jewish students really felt now that they could not be welcomed. And this was reinforced by first a training that was agreed to also by the leadership of these clubs, a Palestine 101 training, where there were actually Jewish students who went, who I think were genuinely curious about what was going to be there. And they were kind of overwhelmed by the level of demonization of Israel and Zionism, and even of anyone who would express any kind of a different view on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And in the weeks and months since then, many of the most committed Jewish students at the law school who have felt really stung by these bylaws, they have not been provocative. They have not been trying to stir conflict. They have repeatedly reached out to try to have dialogue and to say, this has been wounding for us. This has been painful for us. Can we have an opportunity to share that? And they've said explicitly, it's not because we are opposed to Palestinian rights. We actually support Palestinian rights. Can we come to your club to talk about why these bylaws made us feel excluded? And they've repeatedly been told, no, we're not interested. One club had to take a vote about whether to let them come to a meeting. They voted no. These students have been, this became very racialized at a certain point. This is definitely partly the fault of outside actors, and I'm sure we're going to talk more about that. But it became very racialized, where these students were told, you're white and privileged, you can't be excluded. Some of these students were attacked with ugly names I won't share here. So this really became an experience of exclusion for these students. You know, I don't necessarily think that these bylaws are anti-Semitic in their intention. I think they're not. But I think in their impact, they are. And as a scholar of anti-Semitism and someone who deals with these issues on campuses a lot, and I try to be super careful, the difference between intention and impact is important. And the effect of these bylaws, for very understandable and frankly foreseeable reasons, was to make Jewish students in large numbers feel very excluded from these clubs. I would also argue, and we can get more into it in the conversation, that when we look at sort of the three major definitions of anti-Semitism that have been discussed in recent years, the IHRA is the most well-known, the Nexus definition, and then the most recent, the Jerusalem Declaration, we actually could say that in all cases, including the Jerusalem Declaration, which says explicitly that BDS is not anti-Semitism, which has been supported by a lot of BDS supporters and a lot of anti-Zionists, that even the Jerusalem Declaration, we are like a half a short step away from crossing one of their lines for anti-Semitism with these bylaws. So I think, you know, there's a lot for people to be upset about. I'll just close this part by saying the bottom line is, it's a real mystery to me why we have to be so afraid of kind of vigorous conversations about these issues, right? The fact of the matter is, there's a lot to debate about Zionism. You don't have to agree with the characterization of Zionism that I gave or that millions of Jewish people give. There's a lot of room for debate about that, but we will have zero debates if we both literally, in terms of the bylaws, and then symbolically and implicitly exclude anyone who has a position that they even think the Jewish state has a right to exist from entering into these clubs, meetings, and having conversations about it. And the conversation we're having today is really important, right? We should have lots of conversations like this on college campuses. We will have none of those conversations if the method of solidarity for one side is completely excluding the other side from the room.
So Dylan, maybe I'll just pick, there's a lot that Ethan said. Maybe I'll just pick up on the last point and ask you to talk about it, which is to say, there are a lot of American Jews, probably most American Jews, and a lot of Americans who identify with Zionism. They may not have the same understanding. They may not know a lot of the things about Zionism that you know and that Palestinians know. But if you want to change perspectives and you have a strong argument, wouldn't it kind of make sense? And you're upset, and you're rightly upset that groups like Hillel are not allowing that debate to take place. Wouldn't it make sense actually to invite that conversation, to let people hear what Zionism actually is for Palestinians, such that they might reconsider perhaps their support for Zionism, rather than just saying we're not going to be part of the conversation?
I mean, we're telling them what our definition of Zionism here. That's why everyone's so upset, because it's incongruent with how they self-identify, right? The point of these actions is to disallow this passive definition of Zionism that's connected to my Jewish identity. It's something I feel, right? All of that basically operates to sustain the status quo. Because the issue here, the fundamental issue here that we have, is that you have a group of people, right, who are so attached to the idea of Zionism as a permanent demographic majority of Jews in a state of Israel, right? They're so attached to that that they're willing to tolerate just an obscene amount of injustice in order to sustain it, right? So what we're trying to do, what the movement is trying to do, is surface that, is to elevate, this component of demographic control and inform people that this is actually what means to sustain Zionism. You know, the question of discussion and debate, like the white-collar collective, right, is not going to have a debate about what Zionism means. You know, just in the way that SJP is not going to have a debate on like abortion rights, right? It's like that, like these groups, like, know where they stand on these issues. You mentioned, like, well, you know, they may have had a torts lecture of someone who's like happens to be Zionist. I don't think the Women of Color Collective is having torts lectures, right? These are political organizations, that's sort of the point that we're making here, that this is an act of political solidarity insofar as it makes people who identify as Zionist uncomfortable, because what they're hearing is that how they self-identify is incongruent with what Palestinians are saying Zionism is and is doing to them, then that's good. Then that's fine. You know, it's good to be, you know, it's good for people like that to be uncomfortable. But our, you know, but the object of the movement is not to approach the people, you know, have all kinds of investments against our liberation, right? And try to, you know, beat them down. We're trying to build a mass campaign here, right? So there's all kinds of people who don't have those investments, you know, who are persuadable, you know, and who, you know, if, you know, informed about the reality of Zionism, may be motivated to organize against it. So that's the strategy here. It's like the question about, you know, debates, you know, with people who, you know, who are vociferous opponents of the real, the bottom line of what Palestinians are demanding, right? It's a little bit aside the point. Like, I don't know if either one of you has ever, you know, participated in a door knocking campaign, but when you do, you know, what they tell you at the beginning, right, is if someone's wasting your time, you know, attacking all of your assumptions and, you know, and kind of the implicit premises of the message that you're spreading, you don't sit there and you know, and try and beat them down. You move on to the next door, because that's what mobilization looks like. And then insofar as like the question of, you know, the feelings of Zionist students or what have you, I'm just not sympathetic, to be honest. I mean, the basic premise of solidarity is, you know, you show solidarity with, you know, with me, and then I show solidarity with you. That's like a mutual recognition of oppression. That's the basis of it. It's just not persuasive to me when people are dying every day in Palestine. You know, when, you know, my grandfather just died in exile. People I know, their grandparents are dying in exile. This is like, we're at a point where you know, the fact that, you know, the discomfort of Zionist students, you know, kind of being elevated in this debate as being kind of on par with the demands of Palestine activists, you know, is frankly racist. Like, it is part and parcel of the dehumanization of Palestinians. You know, that happens here, and that you know, and that happens over there. My last comment is, I just have to point out, you know, you said that, you know, Zionism is a national liberation movement. Usually in a national liberation movement, you fight your oppressor, not, you know, not the native of the you know, of the land that you're colonizing. So I just had to take issue with that characterization.
So Ethan, maybe I can try to kind of formulate some of what Dylan's saying, and you can respond and take it where you want. And I also want to add in something that Professor Nathaniel Berman kind of put in the Q&A, which I think gets at this too, which is to say, it's true that many people, and obviously many Jews, mean different things by Zionism. It has a lot of emotional and kind of a lot of out of cultural kind of meaning for people and various different things. But isn't it reasonable to say that Zionism is actually the state ideology of the state of Israel? And Israel is doing certain things, right? Things that even its own human rights organizations, not to mention the Palestinian rights organizations and the world's leading human rights organizations, call apartheid, right? Call, to use B'Tselem's phrase, Jewish supremacy. So regardless of what feelings you have and what theoretical debates one might be interested in about what it meant to Achad Ha'am or whoever, kind of that's what it means tachlis in practice. And therefore, just as you wouldn't let someone give a torts lecture if you thought they were a white supremacist, even though it's not what they're talking about, if you believe that in practice Zionism is Jewish supremacy, then it's also reasonable to say that you shouldn't be able to speak to one of these groups.
Right. There's a lot there. So, I mean, first of all, I just, again, I'm a historian, you know, occupational hazard. There's almost no national liberation movement in the history of the world that hasn't done tremendous violence, that has not had tremendously checkered choices, and many of them continue to this day, including systematic exclusion of certain groups. That is in no way to excuse the real crimes of Zionism, of which I am deeply conscious, and of which I think many more Jews should be conscious. And it's in no way to marginalize the Palestinian perspective on Zionism, but it's important to be real about the fact that national liberation movement does not equal some kind of purity. It's also just important on the same note to remember this is not a morality play. It works best as a morality play for propagandists on both sides. It works really badly as a morality play for people living on the ground. So, Peter, to get to your point, Zionism means many things. And I think it's fair to say that one of the things Zionism means today that is really important is a set of state policies on the ground. But Zionism also means a lot of things that are not directly connected to the conflict per se, right? For millions of Jews around the world, Zionism means a place that they can go in times of anti-Semitism. And we are living in a time of rising anti-Semitism in many places in the world. And we've seen many times in Israel's history where Jews who were imperiled were able to go to Israel to safety, something that was, you know, maybe the most central rationale for the creation of the state. Zionism also means a place where the Jewish language, which was a minority language, almost extinct as a spoken language until the late 19th century, is the everyday language. Zionism means the same things in terms of a national culture that lots of national cultures around the world mean, but it's the only state, and a tiny one, for Jews, after Jews, you know, wandered around the world for centuries with no state, right? I mean, Zionism means, you know, there being lots of kosher restaurants. Zionism means there being lots of opportunities to be Jewish in lots of different ways without ever worrying. Zionism means Jews are equal citizens without any question. I know that a response is going to be, well, a lot of that comes on the back of Palestinians. And that's fair. But my point is Zionism doesn't just mean the things that people who are most critical of Israel say it means. Zionism means a lot of things that are not directly connected to those things and that are still very important if we look at the long durée of Jewish history and the reality of the fact that anti-Semitism is unfortunately still very much alive and well, and that like all peoples, Jews have the right to a state. I mean, part of the problem with these bylaws is, to my knowledge, they are exceptional in the gambit of bylaws for any clubs at UC Berkeley, right? I think it's extremely difficult to make a case that Israel is close to the worst human rights offender in the world. That does, again, I'm not excusing the real human rights issues, but this is the only nationalism where you have bylaws saying, if you somehow support this nationalism at all, you can't come into the room. So that I find to be, I mean, at best, it's odd. It's in some manner discriminatory. And, you know, it's not an accurate depiction that you've given, Dylan, of what it means for students to be Zionist or to be, you know, excluded by these bylaws, that they are by definition against Palestinian solidarity. I mean, many of the Jewish law students went to people in these clubs and they said, let us help you rewrite the bylaws as affirmative bylaws on behalf of solidarity with the Palestinians, defense of Palestinian rights. Let us help you rewrite them that way so that we can also support them. There was absolutely no interest in that. So, I mean, both on tactical and I would argue on moral grounds, that's very difficult to defend in terms of, you know, what it means to try to work with other students. And I'll just come back and say, I mean, you can sort of mock them as feelings. But the fact of the matter is, university communities are communities where everyone should feel included. Palestinians should never feel they can't speak. Palestinians should never feel that they are excluded from spaces. The policy of Hillel at Berkeley is far more liberal than Hillel International. There are no restrictions on people who are pro-Palestinian and pro-BDS speaking there on other topics. And they even have panels sometimes with people expressing pro-BDS positions, expressing anti-Zionist positions, so long as they have, you know, another speaker of the opposing view on that panel. So it's, you know, I'm just not persuaded by the idea that the way you have to have Palestinian solidarity is by making lots of people who might actually support your cause be excluded even from being in conversation with you because you've made all kinds of assumptions about them.
I guess I'll let you respond as you want, but maybe I'll just try to encapsulate a certain part of it, which is in my way, which is like, has this decision by these student groups actually been effective in terms of promoting Palestinian freedom? I mean, it seems to me that it's produced a huge amount of conversation about, you know, claims of whether this is or isn't anti-Semitism and whether Jews are or not comfortable on these campuses. And has it really brought the conversation to where you want it to be, which is on the lived experience of Palestinians and their denial of basic rights? Or has it actually become a convenient way for people who don't want to talk about that to actually talk about these things instead? So I'm curious, because you talked about organizing and strategy, to help me understand why you think this has actually been effective.
Sure. So no matter what Palestinians say, Zionists are going to reframe it as a discussion of Jewish feelings and discussion of anti-Semitism and try and, you know, kind of push Palestinians out of the picture. That's the tried and true strategy. That's what we're up against. You know, like I said at the beginning, we don't have a lot of good options. It's not very easy to be a Palestinian trying to organize. There's a lot against you. BDS, I think, is an effective strategy. That's what this is. You know, Professor Katz, you know, said like, oh, like, you know, never seen a bylaw like this. Like, what, you know, what would, you know, motivate someone to treat Israel differently? Like, come on, you know what the BDS movement is. You know why it's here. You know, it's here. You know, it came to be after many, many, many decades of struggle. I do think it's an effective way to reframe the conversation in our benefit. I think that, you know, in conversations like these, we can say, like, look, you know, you point to the BDS demands and you say, okay, you know, if you support Palestinian rights, if you're in solidarity with us, then say you support the demands and you will no longer be a target of BDS. I think it's effective in surfacing that conversation. You know, I think that part of the reason why we're, you know, at somewhat of an impasse here is that, you know, a lot of what Professor Katz was speaking to, you know, is basically like vibes on campus. You know, everyone want to make a welcoming space. You know, everyone feel good, etc. It's just not the priority of the movement. You know, our priority is changing the status quo. We're more concerned with the status quo in Palestine, in ending oppression, in ending U.S. support for oppression, than we are in everyone feeling comfortable on campus. So it's not to say, you know, that campus vibes should never be considered. But in terms of the relative priority, the reason that we're at an impasse here is because, you know, there are people who are comfortable with the status quo, even if some components of it may make them uncomfortable or may make them sad sometimes. And there are people who are opposed to the status quo and fighting for liberation and trying to change it.
I think part of what Dylan's getting at, I also see some of this in the chat, is that there's something problematic about how much time in these public conversations gets focused on the fact that Jewish students feel uncomfortable, offended, even excluded, given the relative hierarchy of harms here, right? You're talking about millions of people who live their entire lives without the most basic of rights. And that there's somehow sometimes in these conversations that a fact that a Jewish student feels excluded and feels uncool, feels unpopular, even experiences that as anti-Semitism, is considered kind of like more important than actually, again, the fact that millions of people are living in this reality that none of us would be comfortable with.
Yeah. Okay. So I understand that. Let me try to put it in sort of simpler terms as I see it. First of all, everybody should be challenged by education. It's fine to be made to feel uncomfortable. It's important to have your ideas challenged. I say to Jewish students sometimes, you know, that what was said to you, that wasn't anti-Semitism. That wasn't even what I would call, you know, anti-Zionism that crosses any lines. It's just, this is fierce criticism of Israel, and you might disagree with it, but it's healthy to hear it, and you have to just accept that this is part of the conversation. So I want to be clear that people being uncomfortable in some broad sense is not my concern, and I don't think it's the concern of most people who have opposed these bylaws. The fact of the matter is we are living in a moment. Context is everything. Context is important to, you know, what Dylan explained, and context is also important to the realities in the American Jewish community today. We're still living through a, you know, 5-year period that has witnessed by far more violence, including lethal violence against American Jews, than at any point in American history. We have had anti-Semitic, unequivocally anti-Semitic, we don't need to talk about anti-Zionism versus anti-Semitism, unequivocally anti-Semitic expressions from major cultural figures, really across the political spectrum, with increasing frequency. We have, anybody who spends time in Jewish institutions knows that compared to 10 years ago, the number of guards at the doors of Jewish institutions, there's no, you know, it's multiplied exponentially. I'm not blaming that on Palestinian students, but just like there's probably, hopefully, lots of things that Palestinians are facing that you wouldn't blame on Jewish students, that's still the reality for the American Jewish community. And so Jewish students are in a situation where they have rational reasons to feel vulnerable, including physically vulnerable. There are Jewish students who were harassed in the aftermath of these bylaws. And so the reality, I think, is if we really want to advance the conversation, there has to be the capacity for some level of mutual recognition. Jewish students don't have to feel that everything they think about Israel is going to be agreed with, but they do need to feel that if they believe in some version of Zionism, they're not going to be told that that just means they have a demonic, monstrous ideology and they have no place in progressive spaces. Just like Palestinian students need to feel that if they support the right of return or they question the right of Israel to exist, they're not going to be told that they can't be in spaces with Jewish students or others who strongly disagree with them, right? I mean, the fact is we don't live in Israel-Palestine. We live on the ground on American college campuses, and our ability to have productive conversations about these issues is really important. We're not excluding Israeli soldiers from these meetings. We're not actually, you know, taking action on the ground in Israel-Palestine. We're trying to figure out what the most effective way, because many, many of us agree that the reality on the ground must change, and it should change dramatically. I also just want to flag the fact that despite our disagreements here about the definition of Zionism, it's not only me and many other Jewish Zionists who have the view that really the position taken in these bylaws is extreme. Rashi Khalidi, for instance, right, someone who's fiercely critical of Zionism, I would say fiercely anti-Zionist, with very deep roots in his family, going back generations in Palestine and the Palestinian nationalist movement, a scholar who's considered by many the foremost expert on the history of Palestinian nationalism, someone I know you interviewed, Dylan, in Jewish Currents back in May. He has been clear repeatedly that he recognizes the reality of Zionism as what he called in that interview an embryonic national movement. In his newest book, The 100-Year War on Palestine, I think the title is clear in terms of what his view is. He's immensely critical of many actions of the Zionists, the Israeli government, the British and American governments on their behalf. But he also writes, quote, Palestinians need weaning from a pernicious delusion that Jewish Israelis are not a, quote, real people and that they do not have national rights. I just want to say that, you know, it's not that Jewish students are simply overly sensitive. It's that the reality is Zionism remains for millions of people a nationalist movement that has empowered Jews in important ways, and that regardless of your view of Zionism historically, for many people, is going to be part of the reality on the ground. And whether you agreed with what the Zionists did 50 years ago, that those who are on the ground today have certain rights as a national people, and that therefore we have to work from some level of mutual recognition if we want to advance the conversation. Mutual recognition doesn't mean you cede everything. If I say, for instance, I recognize there is a legitimate right of return in some manner, that doesn't mean I'm saying, therefore, I think all the Palestinians should be allowed to return. And for Palestinians to say, I recognize that Jews have a legitimate claim to a state in some portion of historic Palestine, that doesn't mean they've said, therefore, Israel as it exists today is fine. And I think part of our problem is we've got these incredibly high thresholds now for what we're willing to cede, and therefore we're not in conversations.
So Dylan, I just wanted to frame that also a little bit. It seems to me that there have been figures in liberation movements who have believed in the fundamental injustice of their opposition, and yet also been able to find a kind of empathy for the fears and experiences that came, that they went through. I mean, I think that Mandela was able to do that vis-a-vis Afrikaner South Africans. And Professor Katz mentioned Rashid Khalidi, but he could have mentioned Edward Said, you know, who writes in The Question of Palestine that, quote, I can understand the intertwined terror and exaltation out of which Zionism has been nourished. And I think I can at least grasp the meaning of Israel for Jews. And that didn't make either of these people any less anti-Zionist, but I do think it suggested that they had perhaps a different strategy in terms of the way they were thinking about what would shift the conversation. And the strategy that you're outlining is a very different one. And I'm curious about why you think it's preferable.
Well, I mean, I guess I want to back up because we're kind of conflating, you know, what Zionism means and what Zionism does. I'm less interested in what Zionism means. I mean, people can have all kinds of views, you know, or hold all kinds of identities. I'm not really that concerned with that. I'm concerned with what Zionism does. And what Zionism does is maintain a mechanism of demographic control. That's the target. That's what we're opposing. You know, when it comes to strategy, again, I just want to surface that it's very clear that we have different objects. The, you know, the object that you're talking about with regards to mutuality, right, is to smooth over differences, to smooth over conflicts, interpersonal conflicts in these spaces in the diaspora, you know, and make everyone feel better and mutually understand each other. My view is that we can do that. You know, we can have truth and reconciliation committees, whatever. We've got to deal with the mechanism of demographic control first. Okay. So it doesn't matter if you and I understand each other. At the end of the day, Netanyahu's still in power. The, you know, the U.S. still, you know, supports Israel full stop, you know, for all kinds of reasons, including imperial ones. And it's not going to make a lick of a difference, you know, whether I have a full understanding, you know, of your, you know, of your kind of emotional, religious, whatever perspective, which again, I also do think I understand, right? I'm not saying I don't understand it. I'm saying I don't really care about it that much in this moment. And the reason for that is because we are trying to actually change the underlying conditions, right? We're interested in structural power, the structural power that maintains that mechanism of demographic control. The reason why, you know, spending all this time on mutuality and mutual understanding is not a good strategy for that is what I was saying before about building a mass movement to apply pressure on these institutions is going to involve bringing in a lot of people who are not involved in this issue, don't have all kinds of, you know, national and religious investments in maintaining this mechanism of demographic control, and building a mass campaign of pressure. And that's going to look like building solidarity with other oppressed peoples. To the extent, you know, that, you know, our Jewish comrades are in solidarity with us, we're also in solidarity with them, right? The Palestinian movement does care deeply about anti-Semitism. What it doesn't really care about, or I guess I'll speak for myself, what I don't really care about, you know, is the feelings of people who are refusing to be in solidarity with us. You know, as soon as we can get on the same page that Palestinians' basic rights are respected, the rights that are codified in international law, the rights to return to their homes that they were violently exiled from, the rights to equal justice under the law, the right to not live under a military occupation where their movement is restrained, you know, where people don't get access to the water that they're living above, where people don't get access to medical care and medical supplies. I don't need to go over all of this again. But my point is that those are the basic premises that we need to agree on before we can start talking about, you know, mutuality.
So, Ethan, we don't have too much time left, but I do think that one of the things that breeds cynicism, not about you particularly, but about the conversation of people who focus on whether this is anti-Semitic, whether it violates free speech, is that the question that I often think about is if those folks don't like this particular strategy, if people don't like this particular strategy that the Berkeley Law students are doing, but they believe that something is fundamentally wrong, the question then, I think, becomes, what are those people willing to do about it? What kinds of changes, pressure would they support? And so I wanted to ask you, like, you obviously don't think that what the students did was right. What do you think that beyond just talking to one another, which I obviously am sympathetic to as well, beyond just talking to one another, what kinds of forms of pressure to change this immoral kind of reality would you support?
That's a fair question. I mean, I think that talking is one of the ways we get to much greater consensus. I mean, I'm very sympathetic to the need for Palestinians to build a mass movement. I'm very skeptical that this is the tactic to do it, in part because there are millions of people you preemptively alienate by not even really knowing what their position is, but keeping, I mean, as I read the bylaws, you would have somebody with an Israeli passport who had not denounced Zionism, who was working for an NGO helping Palestinians in the West Bank, who would not be allowed to speak in these clubs. So it's just incredibly sweeping. So my view is the occupation of the West Bank is immoral. I've felt that way for a long time. I think that's an area where you could rally significant support among many American Jews. And then you start to talk about, okay, what are we willing to do? If you look at American Jews and you look at polling, far more American Jews are open to ideas, for instance, about boycotting the settlements than they are about boycotting Israel broadly, right? That's an area where there's probably room for significant alliances and coalition building. The fact of the matter is, you know, I hate to sound sort of, you know, whatever about it, but the specifics and the contexts really matter. If you want to get into the weeds and you want to sit down and say, okay, what do you need as someone who believes the state of Israel has a right to exist, but believes it must change dramatically? What do you need to feel in this conversation that you're not basically joining a movement to dismantle the state of Israel? What do you need to feel that? And then what can you support to dramatically change Israel? And there's a lot of room. There's a lot of room for people to work together, right? And that's part of what the Jewish law students who were upset about these bylaws were really trying to say, right? But if we don't let people in the room, the coalition building is almost impossible. And the reality that I was trying to point to on the ground, and you can say it's unfair, but the reality psychologically is right now there's a huge number of people in the American Jewish community who are rocked on their heels by the sense that if you have a whiff of support for Israel about you, you are so suspect, you cannot be in a progressive conversation. And as long as they feel that way, as long as they feel completely unrecognized as supporting one of many national liberation movements in the world that have both good and crimes in them, but it's not evil by supporting that movement, they will have a much harder time entering into coalitions. So there's an enormous cost to making them feel utterly and categorically excluded. Dylan, you may feel that that cost is lower than what you're gaining by. I'm very skeptical of that, both on strategic and moral grounds.
So I think, Dylan, you probably have the last word. And I guess I wanted to ask, partly, this is a conversation in which you are in a conversation with, I think Professor Katz would define himself as a Zionist. I actually even, despite the fact that I think most of my critics don't believe me, actually am quite sympathetic to the cultural Zionist tradition that starts with the Chad Ha'am and Martin Buber, which believed in not a Jewish state, but an equal state that recognized communal autonomy for Jews as well as for Palestinians. So even I may perhaps run a little bit afoul. I'm curious that I'm very deeply grateful to you that you made this decision to participate in this conversation. And I'm curious what your thinking was to do so, given that you're also defending the fact that these groups didn't want to have a conversation with Zionists.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, the first thing I'll point out is that I'm representing the students. So I'm on the clock right now. The reason why I'm doing all of this media is because these students are getting harassed because of, you know, Zionist, you know, smear articles and what have you. You know, there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of kind of like targeted harassment on these student groups. And so I'm, you know, doing my job as a lawyer to defend them. I personally, you know, have gone back and forth about participating in events like this, you know, in the debate format. You know, I think that there's drawbacks, there's upside, but I wouldn't really compare it to, you know, what the students are doing. And the other thing I'll say, again, I just want to emphasize, BDS is not really about the actual act of exclusion itself. It's about conveying a message. And it's about asserting our definition of what's happening, our definition of Zionism, which, you know, we've had the pleasure of really teasing out today. So I do think that it's successful. I appreciate the strategy advice. I think we're going to stick with BDS. You know, I recognize that, you know, we may have different objectives here. And as I've stated, kind of different medium term and potentially long term horizons. So it's the tactic that we're, you know, that we're going with. The other thing I'll say is that there seems to be this like insistence that, you know, the counterpoint to the Palestinian solidarity movement is American Jewry. And it's just not the case. You know, we're trying to build a mass movement. You know, there's, you know, 320 whatever million Americans, you know, about 2% of them or what have you are Jewish. Right. So I totally understand that if our entire object was to convince American Jews away from Zionism, then a certain amount of tact, you know, that, you know, may be advantageous in certain contexts. But again, we're working kind of on a bigger scale. We're trying to build a global movement of solidarity, and kind of preemptively making concessions, in terms of framings and definitions, to persuade people who have emotional and religious attachments to Israel and the demographic. The mechanism of demographic control that sustains it, is a bit secondary. So that's basically it. That's the strategy. I appreciate this having this conversation with Peter and Ethan.
You have been listening to attorney Dylan Saba with Palestine Legal and professor of history and Jewish studies at the University of California, Berkeley, Ethan Katz, with journalist and professor Peter Beinart. This was a classic Palestinian-Israeli discussion, and that is why I played it. It illustrates the basic difference between the pro-Palestinian movement and most Jewish responses to it. The Palestinians are done talking and are building action strategies to oppose a militant military occupation of their land, while pro-Israelis too often just want to talk about it, have dialogue that over the years has gone nowhere because it is talk and not action and makes no impact on Israeli governance. Those days are over for the Palestinians. They are building a resistance to a devastating military takeover of their homeland. And the response to their direct nonviolent action is too often that it is unfair and makes some Jewish students uncomfortable and excluded. If a pro-Palestinian speaker comes to campus, the Jewish students want their point of view represented in the program. However, how often does Hillel invite speakers on the Palestinian side to their events? Palestinians have the right to define their programs, their strategies, their resistance on their terms without the involvement of the other side. Okay, so much for my rant. That is it for today. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at the WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.